you have moved up the ladder.
Well, so to speak, yeah.
From $6 an hour to $6.50 an hour?
It's a little better than that, but yeah, that's close.
How many hosts are under your command, so to speak?
There's five of us all together, including myself.
And that's expanded since two or three years ago, right? Have you picked up a couple of hosts or a position and a half?
Well, when I started, there was four. Now we have five. And that was primarily because we added two for the summer, and then the former supervisor quit, and we retained the two that we hired for the summer, and they came on full time. So it's basically the same, one extra person from last year at this time.
How many hours a day do you do this kind of work?
Each host works a 40-hour week, a 10-hour day, 10 to 8, 7 days a week, you know, almost year-round. You know, there are a few days we don't work.
What does the job largely consist of? Is it fair to say it consists of anything largely?
Basically to help people, find what they're looking for. Information directions is a good portion of what we do. But then there are various codes that we remind people that if they're in violation, if they have a dog, if they're riding their bicycle on the sidewalk, skateboarding, etc. There's, where you can sit, where you can't, where you can, how you can panhandle, and what's acceptable, what's not. Primarily, it's how to make the place a desirable place and a comfortable place for everybody.
Well, of course, you don't take your marching orders from the community, but rather from the Downtown Merchant Association. Downtown Management Corporation, which is largely the creation of the Downtown Association, as I understand.
That's correct. Actually, the Downtown Management Corporation is a nonprofit agency that was set up primarily to establish a host program. That's the only purpose they exist.
Now, of course, I've been an inveterate foe of the host program, and there's no secret to that, as well as of the downtown ordinances that you're largely charged with enforcing. I've noticed from the different host reports that the second largest category of stops you do has to do with telling people that contacts regarding sitting on the sidewalk, which I would assume also involves sitting on the planter or rims and so forth, is that a fair description of, I know your first largest category is information, but your second largest category that I've noticed has been these sitting warnings or citations, I guess, police cited you guys warn, right?
Well, actually, okay, I'd say more than 50% of the contacts are information directions, okay? And actually, the percentage of, if you're talking just about, reminding people where's the best place to sit or not to sit, maybe 10%, probably less than 10% of our contacts, I would guess.
Because I know that is the second largest category, at least two of the recent host's monthly reports you can pick up at the Downtown Management Corporation, actually just across the street from where we're having this little interview here. We're in front of the
Copy Roasting Company.
Santa Cruz Copy Roasting Company. And it's about 315, 320, I guess, is where we're at now.
It's almost 330, I think.
We're moving right along.
Yes.
You've told me that, candidly, that you can only remember one time you actually, should we say, to use the vernacular on the street, snitched out someone for sitting down in a forbidden zone against a railing, I think it was. Generally, you simply advise people about what the ordinances state and don't take it further than that. But on this one occasion, you want to describe what that was all about?
Yeah, I'd like to clarify. Actually, it wasn't, it was sitting on a planter box railing. And if you look at the railings, they actually invite somebody to sit on them the way they're designed. If I was to design them, I would design them with scallops or something so that they weren't so... It lend themselves to have the appearance that would be nice to sit on.
Well, anti-homeless architecture is kind of becoming a part of many big cities.
No,
benches
but,
are becoming spiked and such.
No, yeah, right. That would be preferable. But the point is that it's also... There's a liability issue. If you go over and you grab onto one of those railings, they can come loose, and I think that they could be a hazard. I mean, they could fall off. They can, people could go to sit on one and fall, and then, we're in a litigious society, and then the city gets sued.
But you've never known of any such thing ever to happen.
Oh, no. But the case, the specific case you're describing, actually, it was an individual who was asked politely not to sit on the rail and chose to get nasty about it and again yell obscenities at one of my co-workers, and you used the term snitch him off. I actually radioed for backup, and a police officer came over and cited the individual for sitting, illegal sitting. And in that case, I felt it was totally justified, so, and I would do it again.
Well, I appreciate your candor. Of course, my reaction to that would be certainly abusive language or undue hostility can be a separate crime of itself, assault of a kind, or intimidation, even a battery if you're touched by the person involved. However, if I came up to you and said, okay, get out of your chair, you know, and you might say, well, fuck you, man, I mean, depending on how I did it, particularly if I had a uniform on. If you didn't want to be intimidated, you preferred not to use the kindly approach or the appeasing approach, you might express some hostility to someone telling you to do something you regarded as outrageous. Now, many of us, of course, regard these laws as merchant-designed ordinances to give the police selective enforcement powers against people that they choose to move along.
However they originated, okay, you the way you characterize it as, the only part of the clarification that I would make is that if I see somebody with a dog, I don't check and see if the amount of credit cards, the diamond rings on their hand, et cetera, et cetera. If they have a dog, I ask them to take their dog off the mall, the avenue. Again, and that applies to anybody that doesn't follow the simple rules to coexist on the avenue. I don't see anything wrong with that, per se. It's not selectively enforced in terms of how I personally, educate and inform. That's how I see what I do, is I educate and inform. We don't have any citing ability, the ability to...
No, you are the eyes and ears of the police, and the literature of the downtown association.
Actually, technically, we're security guards, because we're paid, and administration goes through first alarm. So, technically.
It's interesting that I know several years ago there was a controversy about a host using pepper spray. Has that reoccurred as far as you know?
No host today is using or carrying or any kind of, baton, pepper spray, any of those devices there, So
I've green shirt, however, it does seem to be a part of the apparel you're carrying with you. The deadly green t-shirt.
I guess it's in the eye of the beholder.
Well, I often, as you know, you don't have a German Shepherd attack dog with you, like Officer Brandt likes to sport up and down the mall as he sort of walks along in his jaunty fashion. On the other hand,
dogs are not allowed leashed or unleashed, unless you...
That's a police officer, not a dog, as Officer Brandt will assure you. He has special powers to arrest people for smoking marijuana and to terrorize people that Officer Brandt chooses to terrorize.
That's your interpretation. I haven't experienced him other than walking his dog up and down the avenue. So I mean, I haven't experienced.
No, I haven't seen him terrorizing people with his dog. But I can see no other reason to have a police dog on Pacific Avenue than to suggest that as a possibility, to frighten people that he chooses to frighten. Now, you might say, well, those are people engaging in the commission of crimes. But you see, there are so many things on this avenue that are regarded as crimes by one group of people and yet not by another, such as what that man is doing right now.
That's not against the law.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yes, sir.
That's a plantar lip, and I can show you police citations for that. That's a violation of 9.50.020.
My only interpretation, the way I was instructed, is that if you stand on that, that's okay. What's not okay is to put your feet or stand inside where the tree is, because it damages the roots. It's not a good idea to tie your...
Sounds like you take a more reasonable interpretation of the law than the police do, because Officer Eveleth recently gave a ticket to Sean Alimi, Feed the People food distributor, for doing even less than that man is doing. He had his foot, one foot on the pavement and one foot on the lip of the planter. In fact, it's unfortunately true. I wish you were correct. You're not. Police have not only found it illegal to do that, but taking people to court for it. As you can see, it's innocent behavior. It doesn't harm anything. It's simply a tool
what those three youth are doing over there, sitting on the lip of the planter, is also illegal behavior. I hope I'm not instructing you on how to harass them, by the way. But, you know, it's such frequent behavior downtown that we will see hosts telling people not to do that, or police telling people not to do that.
Okay, first off, I was instructed by CSO Phil Malotti, okay, and through the course of the orientation to the job, there are places to sit. Obviously, sitting up against a merchant storefront is not an appropriate place to sit.
That's public sidewalk.
It's 6 feet off of the... Well, because then you're obstructing the merchant's ability to display their merchandise. I mean,
From a window? It depends.
No.
If you're in front of the window, it's one thing.
No, it's 6 feet from the window. But then, if you actually came out 6 feet from the window, you'd be standing in the middle of the sidewalk.
Yes, but if you sit right here, it's illegal. That's also 6 feet.
If you sit next to it, in other words, that's...
Well, yeah. True.
So in other words, the law has nothing to do with obstructing merchant windows. It has to do with, setting up a series of codes. Hey, Ernie.
Pieces, brother.
Yes, sir. We're all in pieces these days. We disagree on this law. I mean, let's admit it.
I don't necessarily disagree. All I say is that there is a code. It's a municipal code. It's there on the books. Now, how it got there, I wasn't around when it was written, so I can't speak to that.
And we'd like to hear more of that host dialogue, but we are running short of time. We're going to turn directly to a bit from Mike Rotkin on KSCO talking about the sleeping ban. Those are particularly for those sleeping ban archivists and buffs who'd like to hear this but didn't have an opportunity to. Mike is, of course, a supporter of the sleeping ban. And I'm going to apologize right now in advance for not being able to play the rest of the city council discussion. It is here. Unfortunately, the collated version that I had found is not available, and what I'm going to have to do is run through the tape and do some skipping around. I can't do that right now. But I will assure listeners that I have listened to the city council statements by the incoming council candidates. The only people who said anything about the sleeping ban or the winter crisis were Mayor Byers and Crone. Neither of them really used the word winter crisis in any significant way. Byers talked about revisiting the camping ban and about how bad it was that people got written expensive tickets, but gave no timetable and then refused afterward to talk about the issue or to commit herself to talking about or acting on the issue before January. Crone, when approached afterward, confirmed that he himself would not commit to any kind of action on any of the upcoming city council agendas of this year. To me, that means no action. I mean, that's pretty clear to me, and I think that's contemptible and bad, and something that this council should not be allowed to get away with. This is a we're not talking about they do have a schedule for dealing with the Tidelands on the 8th of December. They will be coming back to undo the Tidelands giveaway that happened under the Rotkin-Matthews Council, and good for them for doing it. But they can't seem to deal with a much more important issue in terms of the lives, health, safety, decency, and human rights of hundreds and hundreds of people this winter. Or if they are, they're keeping it a secret from all of us at the moment, and maybe they should be encouraged to speak up about it. 429-3550, and then push the pound key, is the city council 24-hour message line. Do give them a call right now, even if you called them before, and say, what are you doing around the sleeping ban? You have to act on it before December 8th. Call a special session on the 15th, or give us your timetable and what the hell you're proposing as an alternative, please. That's my suggestion. Now we're going to hear a bit of Mike Rotkin on KSCO talking about the sleeping ban. I will interrupt this with a few comments of my own in the remaining and declining minutes here. And I'll also remind you that if you want to be not just a listener but an active participant in ending the sleeping ban, you can not only call that 429-3550 followed by the pound and followed by a strong message to City Council, but you can also show up 3:30 tomorrow downtown on the Mall on the busiest shopping day of the year and support us in making the shoppers aware that there's more going on in Santa Cruz than
tinsely Christmas displays. If you want to help out, you can call 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's the headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Now let's hear a little bit of Mike Rutkin on the air on KSCO a few days ago.
You are listening to KRMY Watsonville. This is the political wing of the Technobabble.
It's also Cyril
and
Paul.
And joining us on the live line, KRMY live line, is Mike Rutkin, the Seneca City Council.
All right, let me move into this subject. It's near and dear to my heart. For the last 15 years, I have considered the
You're
city
listening
of
here to Westside Al calling in on the line.
Encouraging more people to show up in this city to take advantage of the situation, not only the friendly ambiance, but the number of social services. And I know in the past, Mike, you've been quite proud of the amount of time and money that the city does spend on homeless services. As the majority of the council has shifted slightly, and we see now that one of their priorities is going to be to lift the camping ban, I become even more alarmed, because as it stands right now, almost every piece of greenbelt, so-called greenbelt property in this city is occupied by a de facto homeless campground.
It's ironic that Westside Al says that one of their priorities is to lift the camping ban. It's not. It's not even to lift the sleeping ban sections of the camping ban, more to the point. They're going to get tarred for this thing, and then they're not going to be doing it. It's kind of ironic. They're going to get all the blame, and they're not going to have any of the positive stuff unless they act immediately in the middle of the winter shelter crisis. Because what would be most justifiable in the eyes of the community, what would be more justifiable than acting when there's a winter shelter emergency? It makes perfect sense. They could even do it for a limited period of time if they wanted during that period of time. It makes complete sense during Christmas. Is the best time to do it. The fact that they're not doing it shows either extremely bad judgment or, in my mind, bad faith, and it's not clear which of those two is happening. Let's continue listening to this debate. The Westside Al has also talked about homeless campgrounds taking over all the spaces. Preposterous. It's true there are homeless people sleeping there up in the Pogan, up and out in the wild areas. That's because they get hassled if they're in closer. And there are no campgrounds for them to sleep in, obviously. But we don't hear Westside Al talking about that, nor will we, nor have we heard our council talking about that.
It's the Poganip, Lighthouse Field, along the railroad tracks leading up to Boulder Creek, along the San Lorenzo Levee. We have homeless people coming here for varied reasons. Most of them are not originally from here, and I am quite alarmed about what lifting the camping ban is going to do to further exacerbate that problem.
Of course, Westside Al's figures that homeless people are not from here. He doesn't give us the basis for his saying that. Most people I talk to are, maybe means born here. Well, what percentage of the town was born here would be the next question. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that most of the homeless people I talk to, or a significant majority of them, have been around for a while. You can see that by showing up at the Veterans Hall today when many, many homeless people were fed, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, many of them sleeping outside and facing the negligence and indifference of the city council that could have done something on the 24th. Again, it takes such a long amount of time to do something that you have to start the process immediately. If that council had begun that process by putting something on the agenda, the police force would have been given notice to stop ticketing and harassing. They have not. Now, maybe they're having some secret communications with Chief Belcher. Let's hope so, shall we? But in the meantime, call them at 429-3550, then push the pound key to get the message to all the council members. Get off your butts and do something to restore human rights to homeless people before Christmas.
Point. Is there anything that the new powers in the council can do? Are they going to be successful in lifting the ban?
Well, let me say, first of all, I don't, my own view is that the services that we have provided so far may have some minimal impact on bringing people here who otherwise might not be. We do know from a number of surveys that have been done that the vast majority of people who are homeless in Santa Cruz come from Santa Cruz County, some from the city of Santa Cruz, some from other areas throughout the county, rather than from some other place in the country or other place in the world. There's, you know, I wouldn't argue that there's no attractor from having these services, but I've always argued that the question of having
if that if you allow people simply to sleep in the streets with no limitation, that that will in fact draw people from other areas, particularly with other communities like Berkeley and San Francisco have been cracking down on homeless people. So the question of whether the camping ban is modified in some way, now I think that it should be clear, the new members have not said they're going to get rid of the total camping ban. What they've said is they intend to modify it, and I think it's going to be very important to look at how they're thinking about doing that. Things that loosen the camping ban and make it more difficult to enforce, I think will have a negative impact on neighborhoods and on, again, depending on how it's done, on neighborhoods and on just general factors. And ironically,
2 points to be made in terms of what Mr. Rotkin is saying. This is the first time I have ever heard him publicly admit that there is a sleeping ban. The sleeping ban sections are what the council is talking about loosening. And I find it significant he's making this distinction. He usually ignores it and talks about the whole camping ban, smearing protesters as being concerned with a broader reform. And there's actually nothing wrong with going after the whole camping ban. People need tents or themselves to guard against the wet weather, as well as just the assurance they're not going to be arrested for sleeping. But most of us have recently been going after the sleeping sections of the camping ban. It is significant, however, that Rotkin is now acknowledging that the council is going after those sections, I think, because he, to some extent, believes that the camping ban itself is some crucial thing that if it were lifted as an entire piece, it would devastate the city in some way. I've heard this myth also promulgated by other people. I don't think it's the case. And in so doing, I think he is trying to sort of encourage the council to take lesser steps rather than the larger step, which it's not considering taking. There is no indication it's even considering the lesser steps. The second thing he talks about is removing standards for enforcing the ban. You'll hear him give a whole bunch of misstatements around this. In fact, the camping ban can still be enforced. It's the presence of camping equipment and the intention to stay overnight and being in certain areas at certain times and refusing to move when asked, at least that's what we had in the sleeping ban repeal initiative, that are significant. But sleeping itself is no longer a crime. Rotkin apparently either does not understand this or is deliberately misstating it. You'll hear him talking about this more.
May overtax the existing social services that we provide for homeless people. So some of the people who are most in opposition to screwing around with or lifting or modifying the camping ban are the people that actually have to provide the food and shelter and other kinds of services for homeless people in this community. But I think they realize that if a large number of people are drawn here, that either it's not totally correct with the idea that somehow it's now easier just to sleep in your car or sleep on the streets or in the parks of Santa Cruz, I think we will be overwhelmed with a problem. So I don't, and for many years, to make clear, I do not support modifying the camping ban. I support providing more services for homeless people so they don't have to sleep outdoors. But the new council seems pretty clearly intent on making some kind of modification of the camping ban, and I hope the public will be involved in that process, whatever their views are, and let people know what they think about what's being proposed.
Rotkin's attempt to expand services has included closing down the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, which made hundreds of people homeless, giving them a 2-week stay in the campgrounds, and then cutting them off. Not a very good record, Mike, but at least you are out of the majority in that council.
Number one, Mike, the camping ban is largely unenforced because most residents have just simply given up. It's a very low priority on the police's agenda. They put it at the bottom of the list. If they get there in time to even find the people, they just let them go. They don't run a warrant check on them. They don't search them for weapons. They don't do the normal things that you would do. And I'll tell you, I'm quite amazed at the amount of crime reports that say that it was a transient that was the perpetrator.
Al's perspective on this, although I like him as an individual, is completely opposed to my experience. I find that there are always warrant checks being run, that people are getting tickets a lot or harassed. And then again, his sort of insinuations that transients are involved in a lot of crimes sounds to me like a form of prejudice and stereotyping, but let's go on.
I don't understand this desire to attract more of them. Also, you quoted a survey that was reported in the Sentinel recently that said that most of the homeless in Santa Cruz City come from either the city or the county.
Well, actually, those are most of the homeless who are using social services.
That's right. But on the other hand, I would love to have the job, and I would do it very reasonably. You send me downtown, I'll interview every homeless person I see. I'll ask them, where did you come from, and why are you here? And I will bet you that we have 75% of them that are not from Santa Cruz County, and they're here because of the tolerant attitude and the freebies.
Well, I've spent a lot of time, I'm sorry to interject here, guys. I've spent a lot of time both downtown, and I've spent a lot of time in the outlying areas of Santa Cruz County, both in the past and today. And I've noticed a really, a decrease in what you would call the homeless problem.
Of course, what we have is the bigotry problem, but we can't get into that now because what we're going to have is the environmental realities coming your way. So get your notebooks and your pencils and your papers out because Uncle Dennis is on the rampage coming up at you. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 o'clock with another edition, the Sunday edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, 2.5 hours coming at you big time. And also I'll be downtown at 3:30 tomorrow. At a table, and I'll be happy to debate any of you weenies who somehow think the city council is the cat's meow and is all set to throw the camping, the sleeping ban right out the door. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I wish it were. I hope it does become the case. As far as I know, it's not the case. But, hey, stay with us for Uncle Dennis, and, hey, more of me on Sunday and on Friday. Broadsides, interrupting what sounds like an important and interesting tape, but we've got some important stuff coming up now on 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, for the next, stay with us till 1:30, and we'll see how long we can hang around after that. This is your host, Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris, for the Sunday, November 29th edition of 1998 of Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz, with interviews with Bear Lincoln, victims of police violence, possibly some phone interviews with the new council inner circle, and we're trying to get the city council on the phone too. Maybe we can get you on the phone. Give us a call at 427-3772.
I've been homeless since I was a teenager, and Sean was a hero, working, you know.
And welcome to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. It's a wet, rainy day out there today, and we're going to begin this particular edition by hearkening back to a very important and very educational session we had about 3 weeks ago in Monterey, a forum against police violence. You may, if you can beg, borrow, steal, or otherwise take a peek at the Santa Cruz County Urinal, or the Cent Anal, or the Sentinel, as they call themselves, you'll see a little cartoon in today's Sentinel satirizing the two city council members, Crone and Sugar, peeking in the window where, as a rapist or an assaulter is attacking a little girl and asking for signatures for increased police review board powers. We need some good cartoonists, folks. If any of you have any of those skills, it would be a sweet thing if we could get some counter cartoons going. We actually, of course, need a counter newspaper. The Sentinel is the worst. And unfortunately, it goes out to almost everybody who just wants to see what the movies are. So we need something in their place. In any case, police violence is a real issue for many of us. Police misconduct is an issue for more of us. And there seems to be a real chance on this one occasion that there's actually going to be a prospect for some kind of at least discussion of a change in terms of monitoring our own police force. Who knows, maybe even discussing more radical alternatives to than using guns, pepper spray, and batons as the rule of law in Santa Cruz, because we have this new city council, which two members of which had the courage to show up at a Happy John Dine memorial concerned about police violence and stolen lives. Now, about a week before that memorial, actually it was even a few days before a week, the same Stolen Lives Memorial was going on in Monterey, and we had there was actually a 2-day seminar down there
where folks gathered who had lost relatives through police violence, police murder as they called it, and talked about their situation. We're going to hear an interview now with one of those survivors, one of the family members of a man killed by the police. And I guess I feel a little bit guilty that I haven't put this tape on the air. We're really trying, still hoping to kind of patch a little time together and get together a couple of loop tapes. So Free Radio Santa Cruz will have this police violence forum in a usable form, and we'll hope to do that. But until then, stay tuned and listen to this interview, which gives you a taste of what may be to come in terms of our understanding issues of police violence from those almost most directly affected by them. Yes. Of the Sonoma County families, is that right?
Yes. I'm here to speak for the 17 dead in the last 2 years at the hands of police that occurred in Santa Rosa and environs in Sonoma County, which is the most vicious county in the state and perhaps in the nation, in that statistics show that our death rate by police is higher than New York City or San Francisco or any major urban area per capita. However they figured that out, that's the statistics that I have. In that time, 6 police officers have died while on duty since record keeping began in 1920. 2 of those policemen actually died confronting a criminal. The other 4 were car crashes, heart attacks, etc., suicides, whatever. But they're always lumped as, you know, people who gave their lives. And
I'm talking just about one police department, about a number of different jurisdictions.
We're talking about Sonoma County, and that is made up of lots of little communities. There was, for instance, one death in Roanoke Park. They have a police department.
The Asian American man?
Yes. My son was one of 5 individuals who lost their lives while in custody at the adult detention facility in 10-month period, in one 10-month period. These deaths are always covered up, always hidden. Information is never given. I have no idea. I have no information other than they tell me that my son committed suicide, which I tell you blatantly is a lie. Total lie. My son had been arrested for a misdemeanor, as had everyone who died were arrested for misdemeanors.
Was there an autopsy done on your son's body?
Yes, there was. And in fact, they held him for 2 days while they could obtain the services of an out-of-county forensic physician to do this autopsy.
Because you thought that the local county officials couldn't be trusted?
No, because they chose to do it. I mean, I had no control at all.
So this was a police-initiated murder?
Yes, it was.
So they wanted their own boy doing the work?
They wanted someone else so that they would remove them in their minds from any accusation of wrongdoing. Or that, you know, so
or
they got
this autopsy?
Exactly. Or you know, lying. But to me, you know, a cop from Ukiah is the same as a cop from Santa Rosa, as far as I'm concerned. And so I was never given any proof. I was never shown a picture. I read the coroner's report, the coroner's investigative report, which I find highly suspicious in my son's case, because they didn't call him for 2.5 hours after the time they alleged my son died, or they found my son dead. And then he was not on the scene for 6 hours after my son died. So all of his investigation was hearsay, in which he quoted the detective or this sergeant or this somebody said this and that and the other thing. But as a matter of fact, his only personal vision was that my son was lying on the floor in his cell, barefooted, with his eyes closed, and no ligatures were obvious. He had nothing but a bruise around his neck.
And the cause of death was strangulation?
That's what they say. They allege he hung himself, but in actuality, he was in a room with a very small hospital bed that was not more than 2.5 to 3 feet off the floor. Very small, very low. They allege that he hung himself by tying an article of clothing that somehow magically appeared in his cell, around the spring, and then somersaulted over the edge of this bed, and my son weighed 185 to 190 pounds. If he'd have somersaulted, which I know he could not have done, he was not...
Not a gymnast?
Not a gymnast. He was a guitar player. Mm-hmm. So he would have had bruises on other parts of his body that he had none, so they say. But
how do they know he's somersaulted? Did they see this so-called death?
They lie. They concoct.
Did they claim that they saw it?
No. They simply said they determined that this is what he did. This was after three other stories. One said that he hung himself from the top bunk. There was no bunk in the cell. So they changed their story to that he somersaulted over the end.
You think there were three different stories?
Yes, three different printed stories in the Press Democrat.
You want to give us that rundown?
The first was that he was seen a few minutes before his death, sitting on the edge of his bed in no distress, just sitting there, and then they found him dead, hanging from the top bunk with an article of clothing wrapped around his neck and threaded up and over, and that he was hanging there. The next thing was that he was stretched out at the end of the bed to the floor. His body was, and the weight of his body then brought the tension to the article of clothing and strangled him. And he would have had to be absolutely rigid. You know, and my opinion is that if a person loses consciousness, they certainly can't hold themselves rigid. Mm-hmm. And he would have had to be hanging from his heels, you know, which didn't happen, in my opinion. And the third opinion was what I already discussed with
when
you.
When was the last time you saw your son?
It was 2 days before he was arrested.
What was he arrested for?
He got a woman, and he went out on a Friday evening to karaoke and so forth. She got drunk and accused him of flirting with someone and kicked him, jumped in the back seat of the car while he was driving, and by her own statement to the police, kicked him repeatedly in the back of the head, and he defended himself as best he could from the front seat to the back seat. And after it was all over, they were in the parking lot, and he was trying to get her back in the car so he could drive her home. She was very drunk. The policeman came. He questioned her. He said the police report said that she had a little redness on her cheek, and that there was a little bit of blood on the side of her lip. And she said that that it was from a cut in the mouth. But in the police said that the cut in the mouth was so far back, it was invisible. You couldn't see where the cut in the mouth was.
And they accused him of assaulting her?
Yes. And they took him to jail. They also found this wound on the back of his head, which was a large bump. And they detailed it with drawings and diagrams on the police report. And
how old was your son?
37. And they took him to jail and took her home, drove her home. She was too drunk to drive herself home, so they obligingly locked up her car and drove her home.
Had your son been arrested before?
For DUI, yeah.
Have you had any reason, any particular conflicts with police officers in that town?
Never. He doesn't conflict. He's terrified of the police.
Any interviews with people in the jail who might have seen something?
We have not been able to get any information, not even the names of the people that were in the jail at the time. And, or any other kind of information. Not my attorney, not me, nobody has gotten any information. And I can only conclude that if there was a legitimate suicide and he in fact did take his life, why are they taking such pains to hide it? I mean, if it was a clear-cut case, come and tell me and show me the proof, and I would believe it and go on, you know?
I know in recent years there's been talk of a Sonoma Citizens Police Review Board. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, here's my thoughts on that. I think it's ineffectual, and I think that it's, in most cases, the police review board, the citizens review board, as they call it, has no power. They can't fine, they can't suspend, they can only recommend to the existing power structure, which in our case in Sonoma County was absolutely useless. Sheriff Piccinini denies wrongdoing from the beginning to the end, so does the Sean McDermott. You've got to realize that in this facility,
Sean McDermott is
the assistant sheriff in charge of the jail.
These people serve at the pleasure of the what?
The community, I would think.
They're elected?
No, I think the sheriff is elected, but he was the only one running. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, so he got reelected. He had no opposition.
He has a compliant DA who supports him.
Yes, I think so. Yes, indeed. And also, there's this horrible barrier of this code of silence. I mean, this descends visibly around the police community when something like this happens. They are very cohesive.
You've got to talk to police officers yourself?
Absolutely. I went to Captain Ballinger was appointed to be the liaison between me and the police for whatever reason, and I said to him that I wanted my son's journals, which were in this woman's car because he was moving, and she had the transportation into the storage unit, and so I said, I want my son's journals. And he said to me, and I have this on tape because I had a voice-activated tape recorder, and it just had gone on. My sister uses it in class, and it just... but coincidentally, it went on. Mm-hmm. And take this conversation in which Captain Ballinger told me that, quote, it would be an abuse of police power to go and get these journals because they weren't stolen. That my son had placed them in this car willingly, and that they couldn't get it. It would be illegal.
What about the girlfriend?
1 hour later, they were there. They ripped those journals away from... out of Gina's hands. She tells me that they absolutely did a tug of war. The investigator for the district attorney confiscated those journals without due process, without search warrant, without any...
sounds like massive corruption.
Exactly. And I haven't been able to get those journals back. Within an hour of telling me in my home that it was an abuse of police power, this event occurred. And then I called him up and I said, I want my son's journals back. And he said to me, quote, well, if I were a family person, if my son had died, I would want every possible investigative tool to be given to the police. I said, you didn't give it to me. You didn't give me the option of offering you those journals if they were necessary. Whatever those journals were my son's private thoughts, had nothing to do with any misdemeanor, spousal abuse or whatever.
Is the DA claiming he's still investigating this case or the police department?
No, it was supposed to have been concluded in May. And my attorney...
Were the journals returned?
No, they have never been returned, nor anything else. I mean, we're talking about a curtain of silence that nothing has been able to go through. Not my attorney's continual requests or anything. And the reason that they do this is because there's a statute of limitation of 6 months that the families or whoever must file a complaint with the Board of Supervisors as a first step to legal action.
And have you done that?
I have done that, and the reason I have been able to do that is because I went to the law library, I read the laws, I prepared a statement, because in my opinion, after reading the police report, I felt, the statement from Gina, I felt that he had been wrongfully arrested. I felt that she should have been arrested as the aggressor. Mm-hmm. And instead, he was arrested. And so I'm saying I wrote up the brief.
How about a wrongful death claim against the jail?
That's exactly what I did, because that's the only information I could prove. Mm-hmm. That's why they keep everything.
It's costing you a lot of money in legal fees?
Yes, it's costing me a lot of money, most of which I don't have yet. But my attorney is waiving her fee, but I have to pay the court costs. And that is the problem with most families, and that is the problem, and that is why the police and the law enforcement community has the ability to label lawsuits brought against them as frivolous, because most families don't have the money to pursue it. I'm in the process of selling my car to give to the attorney. I will do everything I can. I'm as a chairperson of the Sonoma County Family Group. I am.
How many people are involved in that group?
Well, there are 8 people who come consistently every Monday.
How many of them have lost people through a consequence of police violence?
Everyone.
So there are at least 8 victims we're talking about?
Yes. 8 that belong to the family group, but we have 17 documented cases.
You've been a period of?
Since 1996. 2 years.
And?
Shot, murdered, pepper sprayed. One woman was so brutally murdered in the jail. She was arrested for an outstanding warrant on prostitution. She was a heroin addict. She was thrust into cold turkey, rejection of the drug, and was allowed to beg and plead and cry and push the button and ask for help for 3 days until she died. And this is in with witnesses that were incarcerated with her. Name is Joni Holmes. She's been dead a year.
Any moles in the police department that are friends of yours?
No.
Giving any information?
No, but we have a women's group, a women's advocacy group called the Purple Berets, and Tanya Brennan is very, very good at finding out information. In fact, Tanya Brennan is probably responsible for all the information that I know, and she's the one who got the story out that during this time period, there was an internal investigation of over half the officers, correctional officers, in the jail were accessing pornographic websites as in up until as much as five hours of their shift. And two people were subsequently fired. And finally, 2 months ago, Sheriff Piccinini, in a quite brief statement in the paper, admitted that Mark Keeney, that one of the persons fired, was the officer on duty the night my son died.
What about the election? Any changes as a consequence of the election that might lead you to be more hopeful?
No, I don't. I really do not see any response. I have spoken to the Board of Supervisors with other family members. I have gone and written speeches and spoke to them when they were considering this Citizens Review Board, which I think is just something that they offer as a means of, yeah. And if you have no teeth, if you can't fire, if you can't suspend, if you can't punish, what is the point? You're just accumulating these evidence. You're giving direction.
You're persuading the community. You're doing something when
exactly,
you're not.
Exactly.
What about the community? There have been a number of protests up in Sonoma, particularly around the Asian American death.
Yeah, very, very. But they have never become part of our family group, although we have invited them.
What's the name of that man?
I don't know.
And that's the only case we read about down in Santa
Cruz. You're right. And he was shot in the full view of his family.
Supposedly wielding a broomstick or something.
Right, he was drunk and he was waving this broomstick.
The deadly broomstick.
The
Wizard of Oz broomstick.
He was shot to death in front of his horrified wife, who was not allowed to give him CPR or anything. She's a registered nurse. She was not allowed by the police to remove the stick. She wanted to go take the stick away from him and calm him down, and they would never allow her to do that, no.
How about street protests? How are you doing? Has the community seemed to respond to that at all?
Well, we had a demonstration at the jail.